The following is with David de Jong, who is the Middle East correspondent for the Dutch newspaper FD. He lives in Israel and has been reporting from the ground since the early hours of October 7th. Some of you may recognize him from an early appearance he made in this podcast. There he was talking about his book, Nazi Billionaires. But for this episode, we exclusively talk about David's first-hand experience over the last 2.5 weeks reporting on the ground. That includes the horror of being among the first reporters at some of the worst site hits from October 7th through to the disinformation and how to think about the media coverage of this conflict so far. All links to follow David are in the chat. His Twitter is especially good because he is both tweeting his own takes, but as well retweeting those that he trusts. And also just one more thing, please, if you don't mind, sign up to my newsletter, which serves as a compliment to the podcast, documenting the whole Curious Worldy backlog of guests and ideas so far. I launched it very recently, and I just want to encourage you all to join the community. It's the top link in this chat. And without any further ado, here is David de Jong. Good morning, Mr. de Jong.
Good morning, Ryan.
So I will have just introduced you to the audience again, for those might have listened to the first time around. You're the author of Nazi Billionaires, but you're also the Middle East correspondent for FD, which is the Netherlands' largest sort of financial newspaper. And you're posted in Israel. So you've been in Israel for the last several weeks. And just to open up with, you know, how's it been? You've been writing multiple stories, but I think just a good place to start with asking you, first-hand experience since October 7th.
Yeah, it's been it's been surreal. It's been also just working 24/7. I think I cover the entire Middle East. I don't just cover Israel and Palestine. So, you know, especially with this, so far I hadn't covered any conflict in the region. Well, I generally never covered a conflict before. I certainly never covered a regional conflict. I mean, the stories I usually do are about, you know, anything from IPOs in the Gulf to economic crises in Lebanon and Turkey to, you know, covering the judicial reforms in Israel up to now, or, you know, doing stories in the occupied West Bank, or reporting in the occupied on settler violence, etc. I mean, all kinds of stuff. But yeah, I mean, everything changed on October 7th at 7 a.m. when, you know, I was woken by the air raid alarm, and, you know, jumped out of bed into the so-called Mamad, which is a safe room in the apartment in Tel Aviv. And it became very quickly clear, and there were these reports, and we saw the first videos of kind of armed militias getting into, or, you know, getting into, armed militants getting into Sderot, which is 2 kilometers from the border with the Gaza Strip. And nobody first realized that I didn't first realize the scale of what was happening, because it was really trickling, you know, the information was trickling in, but it was immediately clear. I mean, the text messages I sent to my boss of that morning, you know, in Dutch, let me actually pull them up, because it's quite, you know, it's kind of history in the, you know, it's history in real time in a way, unfortunately. I said to him, you know, who's having the air raid alarms going off? There's been more than 300 rockets fired from Gaza to Israel, and there's also a image of militants that have crossed the border and are shooting at civilians in Sderot. And then there's also apparently a building hit in Tel Aviv. This is going to be very likely war. And it was, you know, I was very happy that he was awake, because It was 6:45. It was seven. It was, you know, the time I sent his mother, it was 7:45 Israel time, so 6:45. You know, on a Saturday morning, right? So, and yeah, from there it just it went, and then it was very quickly. It was state of alert for war, and then the first day was just, you know, I worked out of the office and I had to get a flak jacket and a helmet because it left it at somebody else's. And then I was in the cab with, and then the air raid alarm went off and I was with the cab driver. We were like, so what are we going to do now? And he said, maybe we should just keep driving and it's, you know, it's safer. And, you know, after that, because of course it was a Saturday, in that sense, it was lucky because there was no news, there was no newspaper on Sunday, of course, because the weekend edition was over. So then we really got to work from Sunday on. And I think I wrote, I had four bylines in the Monday newspaper, did four stories. Did a hostage story on Monday for Tuesday. And then Tuesday was the first, you know, time I went into the field. It was safe enough to go into the field to go to do a reportage. And I went to Reim, which is where the trans festival was held in the desert, where you know, at least 260 people were murdered by Hamas militants. And and I was with my colleague Christine Kensche from Welt and our fixer Ronit. And we got kind of strangely, you know, there was a lot of, you know, reporter's luck in the sense that we got access first to things that we had not been no any other journalist. Because thousands had flown in, right? But we had kind of one day ahead. Those correspondents we were based there had kind of one day ahead on the news cycle. So we drove down to Ofakim, and which is also close to the Gaza Strip, which has also been attacked, which is a kind of a sleepy desert town of about 30,000 people. And we walked into a store, and there was this guy, Tommy, and this place was deserted, right? It was a town of a city of 30,000 people, and it was just like no one. And we walk into the store, and this guy told me, we're doing a reportage on what happened at the festival and in the kibbutzes. And he's like, yeah, my best friend, Itzik Budiashvili, was the head of security at the festival, and he was murdered, and I'm gonna take you everywhere. I'm gonna take you all around to Ofakim, and then I'm gonna take you to Reim, and yeah, I mean, it's, you know. I mean, the bodies of dead militants were still lying in ditches, you know, alongside the road from between the kibbutz Reim. So first we went to, first Tommy took us around Ofakim and seeing, you know, and there were burned out carcasses of cars that the Hamas fighters had used to attack Ofakim. There were, you know, bullet holes everywhere, just damage everywhere, right? But this was quite a large city, right? This is also the place where this woman kept the terrorists at bay by speaking to them for like 15 hours. Right? I don't know if you heard that story.
No, I didn't hear that.
This is an incredible woman, and she was interviewed. I think Biden even met with her. Who like was holed up in a house of her husband, and she like spoke, she like kept giving, somehow she kept like giving cookies or like tea to the terrorists, and like she said, oh, I'll teach you, I want to learn Arabic. She kind of flattered them and she kept them like at bay, and then, you know, finally after 15 hours the army came, and and killed them, and she was released or something like that. And so we went to that house. But then, and then we went to Reim, which is, you know, a 10, 15, 20 minute drive from Ofakim. And, you know, that was really kind of a, and that's, you know, 4 kilometers, 2 miles from the Gaza border, from the border of the Gaza Strip. Yeah, and there, you know, there were, the uncovered, often sometimes, you know, almost naked bodies of killed, Hamas fighters lying in ditches in this road between Kibbutz Reim and between the festival grounds. Now, at this point in time, of course, it was 3 days after the, well, it was 24 hours after they had, it was Tuesday afternoon. So it was basically 24 to 48 hours since there had been no more kind of militants, since they declared it like safe, right? So, well, safe, I don't know. I mean, bodies were still being discovered on the festival site. So we didn't get access to the festivals because they were securing that site.
Was this the first time in your life that you'd seen dead bodies?
Yes, it was. Yeah. I'd never seen a dead body, not in my, you know, not in the context of, you know, saying goodbye to a loved one who had passed or you know, for any other reason. This is the first time that I consciously saw. I mean, it was very overt, right? It was a very overt display. Because, of course, as it was later explained to us, you know, they first wanted to take care of the dead bodies of all of those that had been murdered before they would take care of the so-called chablim, as they call it, as of the terrorists. That road between the kibbutz Reim and the festival ground was just, it was a hellscape. It was a hellscape. It's a sight I'm never going to forget, never in my life. I mean, it was burned out cars, dead bodies. And there was this military checkpoint going into the festival grounds. So we ended up going to Kibbutz Reim, which was, which had been attacked, which at that point was kind of the, an act which was kind of the front in a way. There was a lot of artillery around the field that there was constantly going off, or constantly artillery being shot at Gaza in these beautiful green fields around Reim, about Kibbutz Reim. Kibbutz Reim is you know, a beautiful place, right? I mean, it was, the destruction I saw in there, and was incredible. I mean, just houses that had burned, you know, a couple that had been burned alive with, like, in their house. You know, you could smell the stench of human flesh. You know, I mean, and also, but then some houses that had been completely left. They were in pristine state, and others that had been destroyed by the militants. And Reim, contrary to, say, Beri or Nir Oz or Hilot or Kfar Aza, had been comparatively, not spared is not the right word, right?
Not as devastated.
It had been devastated, but they had fewer casualties, right? Where Kfar Aza, Beri, you know, you have 1/3 of the town or 10% of the town slaughtered, and the residents they spoke to ended up, you know, what they said or those that had been there during the attack, said that we had to unlearn everything we learned in the military, which was to directly engage your enemy. And so we played this cat and mouse, because it was 10 of the kind of the security, the protection unit of the kibbutz, right? Which is kind of, which is volunteers, against 50 militants. And they ended up only, you know, quote unquote, you know, 10 people being killed in the kibbutz and one being kidnapped. But the destruction was just, it was just incredible. And, you know, it was all these SUV, all these Toyota pickups, which these Hilux pickups, you know, burned everywhere, crashed everywhere, and, you know, buildings that had just been, you know, residences that had been just completely destroyed. And yeah, I mean, it was just destruction on an unimaginable scale. And, you know, it was a military zone, you know, it was all soldiers there. And it was just when the mobilization had started, right? This is tomorrow, 3 weeks ago, when we were there. It was October 10th. And yeah, so that was my first reportage. It was the first in the field reportage, and yeah, then the second one was at the northern border with Lebanon, that following Sunday, and in the meanwhile, you know, of course, I had to do my, you know, I had to cover the Biden visit. I was doing, you know, all kinds of different stories, but ones that I could do from the office or from the bureau or you know, going to press conference, you know, a lot of hostage stories. You know, the deformity of the war cabinet with guns, and of course, kind of this story about how Israel changed forever, you know, that after that first week. And then, of course, you know, so then I went up to the border with Lebanon, because that was, and to an extent is still, the fear, right, of a second front opening up as soon as the ground offensive, which is by now has been started. But I think, I guess the expectations of a ground offensive were different, right? I thought perhaps people expected that it would have been more massive, a bigger incursion.
You sort of just hinted at it a little bit, but can you speak to the sentiment change among Israelis in the last 3 weeks?
I think it's very well highlighted by what I saw on the Lebanese border, on the border with Lebanon, right? So on Sunday, let me just see here. So on October 14th, it was me and my colleague Christian Meyer from the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, the FAZ, and Omer, Israeli fixer, went first up to speak to a family which had been evacuated from Rosh HaNikra, which is literally on the border, these beautiful caves which are on the border with Lebanon. And they had been evacuated. And this family, you know, like, and people of our age, it was a whole family of 11 living in an apartment, having been moved to an apartment. And, you know, this family, they were quite, you know, and that's also the cynicism of kind of those living in the envelope around Gaza. You know, a lot of them were left-wing peace activists, you know, those that were considered peaceniks, you know. And they, you know, it's especially those living in, you know, in Rosh Hashanah, those kind of those peaceniks, you know, they had really changed their tune. You know, they were suddenly, you know, they were blood, they had become bloodthirsty. You know, everything had to be destroyed. And I think for me, this change among, I mean, and I don't know how that sentiment is, you know, whether that's still 3 weeks in the case, but in those first week, in that first, those first week, 10 days, 2 weeks, it was really this sense among the Israelis I spoke to of, you know, there can never be a peace, you know, we have to just, you know, we have to destroy Hamas, we have to destroy Hezbollah, we have to destroy Iran, you know. And I think, I don't know, I can't speculate, that's not my role to speculate on what's going to happen in the long term, but I think it will have a profound and lasting effect on the psyche, both of Israelis and Palestinians. And you know, after interviewing his family, we went up, and it happened to be the morning where they evacuated the first of 28 towns. I think by now it's been 42 or along the northern border with Lebanon. And we managed to get into the closed military zone, to this place called Mitzpah Hila, which is a beautiful, again, a beautiful town, quite, which overlooks this kind of mountain ridge that is the start of Lebanon. And this place was deserted. And, you know, and we had to, like with Kibbutz Re'im, we really had to talk ourselves in, because it was completely protected by military. And you know, and we were taking around the town. I mean, it was the same Re'im. We were taking around, of course, this was not a town that Mitzpah Hila was not destroyed, right? It was on a front, but on a different front. On a front in waiting, as opposed to a front that was in action. Which also turned out to not be true, because at one point, you know, Hezbollah started firing rockets, and we saw them come down, you know, from these kind of two ridges, because Mitzpah Hila is also on a ridge and overlooks the Lebanese ridge. So we saw it come down into the valley, and then it was artillery fire and phosphorus gas being, or phosphorus grenades being shot at Hezbollah positions. So, yeah, it was yet again, I mean, when I say reporter's luck, I mean luck in the sense of, you know, experiencing these things. Of course, it is not lucky in the sense of any kind of human experience or condition, right? I mean, it's a very twofold, very bittersweet experience. So, yeah, so that was the first week. And then, of course, the narrative, you know, quickly, I mean, well, not quickly, but it the narrative started focusing on what was happening in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, right? You know, in addition to covering what's happening domestic with the efforts of hostage release and kind of the largest mobilization Israel's ever seen. So the third reportage I did was in the occupied West Bank, was these, you know, kind of in the shadow of Gaza, emboldened settlers, backed by the army, that are, you know, forcibly displacing or you know, particularly Bedouin villages, you know, hundreds of people, hundreds of Palestinians from their villages. Because I mean, it is this kind of this cynic twist, right? Where Netanyahu's government, the far right and ultra religious and ultra nationalist government that had been in power for the first 10 months and 2 weeks, the first 10 months and 10 days of this year, until the war cabinet was formed, focused so much on the West Bank, right? On expanding settlements, you know, allowing settler violence to kind of occur unchecked or having the army backing that. Yeah, inciting violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, etc., etc. Really ramping up and totally lost the focus on the Gaza Strip and on Hamas, you know, kind of saying we have this under control and blah, 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 and you know, completely thinking that they had it under control. And it was, I mean, it was, you know, a huge failure, of course, by the Shin Bet, by the domestic security services, because people talk about the Mossad, but the Mossad has nothing to do with focusing on Gaza, right? That's a purview of it's a purview of the Shin Bet, the domestic security services, and of course the army, which arrived way too late, right? As in Reim, you know, the army showed up. The attack started at 7 a.m. The army showed up between noon and two. I think around 2 p.m. So it was eight. It was 7 hours later. You know, and in places like Kfar Aza and near Oz and Beri, it was even more. It was sometimes 16 hours, 17 hours before the army showed up while the attack was in progress. So, but now in the shadow of Gaza, you have these settlers who are, you know, yeah, displacing hundreds of Palestinians in these villages. And we visited three villages. And it was, you know, in Wadi Siq and Mu'a Rajad and Rashash, and it was, you know, one where they had left, where they were forced to leave, one where they were also forced to leave but kind of refused to go in the sense that they're coming back, and thirdly one where they're refusing to go, and it is and they are, you know, also supported by Israeli volunteers, by volunteers who are like, were there 24/7. So the story was also partly about the fear among Israeli activists of, you know, that like after the attacks of October 7th, like of the 50, only half showed up. And people were saying, well, they'll come back, you know. So it was this kind of twofold story of these displacements, of these forced expulsions. But also of kind of Israeli activists doing their, you know, helping Palestinians even now.
I wanted to ask you, David, because, you know, you're in a rather unique position being an expat in the country.
Yeah.
But a foreign correspondent. So like you said, really front of the line when it comes to the reporting. You wrote a piece, I think it was only a few days ago, called It's Getting Harder for Jewish and Arab Israelis to Live Together. So to speak further to this sentiment change, the way you can see it as an outsider.
Yeah. That's a nice full circle, because that's the fourth reportage I did. I mean, there's an incredible fear, right? Among, I think what Hamas seemed to have been banking on was that as soon as they attacked, the occupied West Bank would revolt against the, not only about the Israeli occupation, but also against the Palestinian Authority, right? Which is led by Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, and is notoriously corrupt and in effect, and a lot of Palestinians speak about a double occupation, Israeli army plus PA. But, you know, people in the West Bank are scared, you know, but particularly, of course, I mean, they're used to kind of being about kind of indiscriminate arrests and administrative detention without any end. But of course, what's happening now in Israel, particularly since the war cabinet took office, is that, you know, Palestinians with an Israeli citizenship, of which there are about 2 million, are worried about, are fearing prosecution. Because now, because they've expanded kind of the powers, the war cabinet has expanded powers of the police, and they've expanded the definition of what could, one could be charged for terrorism, so or support of terrorism, which means a, in some cases, a like of you know, the civilian casualties in Gaza, right? Or speaking out against, you know,
what would the consequences be if I'm an Israeli citizen, Palestinian ethnicity, and I'm like sharing a bunch of say pro-Hamas stuff?
You could get fired from your job. There could be like a disciplinary proceedings. It could be an HR complaint against you. You could get fired. There's been stories of students who are now in for disciplinary committees for liking, you know, pictures like that. There's been, there's stories about influencers that have been arrested or that are being contacted by the Shabak, by the Shin Bet, saying, you know, don't post this or that, you know, and. Yeah, I mean that is a new reality for Arab Israelis, and of course also for those Jewish Israelis that, you know, have been working towards coexistence for decades, right? Who are also seeing their entire communities being torn apart, which of course, you know, this was already the country was already being torn apart for 10 months, right? Through, because of the judicial reforms, had pitted 40% of the country, which is centrist, left-wing, liberal, against 40% of conservative or pro-Likud conservative, ultra-Orthodox, ultra-nationalist, settlers, you have it. And then this kind of 20% of Arab Israelis who didn't really engage with all of that debate, because they're like, well, you know, we're in trouble either way, and that is something that, you know, I mean, again, I mean, the conflict, the attacks and the subsequent war between Israel and Hamas, you know, it's 3 weeks, it's just over 3 weeks old, so this is what we're gonna see. I mean, we're gonna see so much, you know. This is only the beginning of it's going to get, it's probably going to get worse before it's going to get better.
So between you and your colleagues, when you are speaking about how things move forward from here, what is the general consensus?
We tend not to speculate on that because we just don't know. And that's not our job. Our job is to report, but we see what we're going on, you know, the 1400, you know, the 1400 that have been murdered in Israel, you know, reporting on the more than 230 hostages in Gaza, on the, you know, on the 8,000, I think by now, 8,000 civilian casualties. Well, it's not only civilian casualties, it also includes militants and terrorists. Casualties in Gaza, the tens of thousands of wounded there. You know, that's a whole nother story, right? Is how to report on Gaza, which is one of the most extreme challenges we have.
How do you tackle that?
You talk to people within Gaza who are risking their lives talking to you, not because you're a journalist based in Israel, because you're a journalist at all, right? And that's, you know, if any of the kind of the security forces of Hamas or of the Islamic Jihad finds out that people are talking to journalists, you know, it's I mean, they control. I mean, I think what's being badly explained, and I've also not done a good job at it yet. You know, Hamas is a government, right, in Gaza. They control the Gaza Strip, right? They are the government. They provide the services, right? and they control every aspect of life. And even though there's only 30,000, 40,000 an estimated Hamas fighters, Hamas militants, you know, terrorists, whatever you want to call them, and 10,000 Islamic Jihad fighters, which makes for like an, so the armed militias for about 50,000. You know, there's also a political bureau. They provide. They are the government. You know, it's just like we talk about the Taliban as a government. I mean, as a regime. I mean, they're a regime, and I think that is often forgotten. It's because if you talk about militants, if you talk about terrorists, like how can they run like one of the most densely populated places? But that's what they do. They provide services. The hospitals are run by Hamas. You know, it's like everything in power is Hamas, right? I mean, that's the power that is there, and that's the power you have to deal with, and that's the power that they rule it with an iron fist, Sorry.
What about, say, the social stigma within Israel? So you've been traveling all over the country, but presumably you maintain lots of conversations with people throughout Tel Aviv.
Sure.
Not all of them being the ultra-nationalist conservative, presumably sure. A lot of them being on the left. Yeah. Is there a sort of social stigma to the Jews that you're speaking to who are not like totally getting on board with what the consensus narrative is?
No, there's no social stigma. I mean, especially now, you know, the people I'm talking to, you know, Bibi is so across the board impopular, right? I mean, he focused so much on his self-survival of, you know, he has these three corruption processes going against him. He teamed up with the most extreme factions. He tried in a democratic way to overturn democracy in Israel. And he divided the country so much and left it so weakened that, you know, they hit at a moment when it was just when Israel was at its weakest. And in the end, you know, Netanyahu is the one who's as the commander in chief, also as the executive for the army, for the security services, is responsible for it. And of course, he had to form this war cabinet with his biggest rival and the opposition leader Benny Gantz, and his Ministry of Defense. I mean, this triumvirate is now Yoav Gallant. This triumvirate is now running the country, because he had his back against the wall. It was either he had to resign immediately or team up with his biggest competitor. And I think, you know, and now, you know, there's day and night, there are demonstrations outside of Hakiria, which is the Ministry of Defense and also the headquarters of the Israeli army, of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, and in central on Kaplan, which is where the demonstrations were also held, the Saturday night demonstrations for 10 months. And now there's day and night people just protesting, you know, the families of the more than 230 that are being held hostage, right? Saying bring them home now, arguing for a ceasefire in order to bring the hostages home safely, which are both, you know, for large part Israelis with second nationalities, as well as foreign workers, right? Then there are those that are there demanding for a ceasefire, you know, that are saying this is, you know, that are arguing for a humane, you know, end to this conflict, you know, which is, you know, how hard that is to even given the current war sentiments. And then there are those, you know, who are fearing, of course, that ground offensive will end up costing the lives of hundreds of Israeli soldiers, as well as just untold civilian casualties in Gaza, which is already, you know, happening on both sides. And want a ceasefire. And then there's also right wing demonstrations who are saying, you know, reoccupy Gaza, expel, you know, 2.2 million Palestinians to Egypt, to the Sinai, let them roam there. And so that, so what's happening now in Kaplan is really a, you know, it's 20, and a lot of people demonstrating were saying Bibi has to resign now. You know, this is his responsibility. And yeah, I mean, it is incredible how Kaplan has become this, you know, continuing hotbed of demonstrations, of protests. And it's really 24/7 these days.
Mm. What do you make of the media coverage, as much as you've been able to consume as well as create?
I mean, it's not really my role to judge on the work of colleagues. That's just not, that's it. I'm too much in it to you know. I know we're all under a tremendous amount of pressure in the field. And I know that, you know, we're all doing the best job we can under what is also, you know, in part a propaganda war from both sides, you know, which one has to balance. It's a very fine balance that one has to engage in, you know, with reporting, because there's a lot of disinformation out there, a lot of misinformation out there, and one has to thread very carefully and verify everything. And I think my colleagues have been doing an incredible job out in the field. What I do say is that, you know, particularly from those, you know, it's very hard on from foreign desks who are not in the country, making judgment calls on, for example, the bombing of the hospital, right, where everybody rushed to judgment based on a Hamas statement, which they didn't know and they didn't verify, that it was an Israeli, and it was on all the front pages the next day, and it was just so incredibly harmful and insidious that got unchecked. And I mean, the New York Times issued a huge rectification, but a lot of, you know, the Dutch media, for example, didn't, who carried the same story. And that, of course, inflames the debate so much, because I'm focused on the Middle East, I'm focused on the region, I'm focused on Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, and the region beyond at the moment. But of course, the domestic debates, in particular Netherlands and Germany, have been just so toxic. And you see all these, you know, social media warriors coming out and being just basing themselves on terrible information and saying just the attacking my colleagues, attacking myself, you know, threats over emails and things like that over social media. And it's, you know. But that's a different, you know, that's a different debate. That's not that is not my focus, because I can separate that. You know, my focus is on the Middle East. My focus is, that's my job. That's what I'm focusing on. What's happening in Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon, and Egypt, and whatever countries, you know, in Qatar and Saudi and Iran, you know, and all of there, you know, it's a big geopolitical game, you know. And
what realities about the Middle East have been revealed to you in the last 3 weeks that you perhaps beforehand you know, didn't fully appreciate?
I mean, none, really, because I mean, I've gotten to appreciate the region more, as strange as it sounds, because of this. That sounds really strange, but you know, there's such humanity in this incredible suffering and destruction as well, and through it all, and people are trying to live with dignity. People are trying to protect the lives of their families, And, you know, and I think you see in this in this conflict particularly, it's just that, that inhabitants are subject are victims of their regimes, you know. Whether it's Hezbollah, which is a state within a state in Lebanon, whether it's Hamas in the Gaza Strip, whether it's the PA or the IDF in the occupied West Bank, or to an extent by the failures of the Netanyahu government in protecting its own citizens, you know. Yeah.
We'll leave it there. Your Twitter bio is in the description for people to follow, things that you retweet and stuff. It's a good way to, I don't know, at least just consume reliable media about the conflict. Are there other places you would encourage people to look at, whether it's a podcast, you know, a certain interviewer, a certain journalist who you think is just who you think is doing good coverage and therefore, you know, should be consumed?
I mean, I think on the, you know, I think on the Israeli side, you know, I think Haaretz is doing an incredible job, you know, and I do have to say, I mean, but I'm saying the same from my colleagues at, you know, Al Jazeera, CNN, the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, Reuters, AP, you know, it's hard to highlight one. My colleague and friend Ref Sanchez at NBC has been working nonstop for the past 3 weeks, you know, and it's doing incredible stories. You know, my colleague and friend Willem Marx for Al Jazeera is doing just really very incredibly reliable coverage. And, you know, all my German colleagues, and there's not that many Dutch correspondents out in Israel and Palestine anymore. But it's but there are also those that are left or those that flew in are also doing incredible work. So it's really it's you know, it's also a communal effort of the media at this point is to get to cover the story as best as it can, and I think to a large extent it is doing that. And but yeah, I mean it's an incredibly hard environment to work in, both security wise.
All right, David. Well, good luck, mate. And we'll keep reading what you're writing and maybe check in a few weeks again.
Sounds good. Thank you, Ryan.